Brocky-Einstein YPQ manifolds. And roughly speaking, if you looked at the explicit metric on the Sasaki-Einstein spaces, you could replace the second S2 over here with something like a y-coordinate and a beta-type coordinate. And in a way, you've destroyed your second S2 over here. So you've lost S2 isometry. That gives you, whoops, SU2 times U1 times U1. You can kind of count the dimension of the space that the orbits sort of fill up under these isometries. And for T11, basically, if you start with a point on this S2, and this S2, and somewhere along this fiber, by just sort of rotating into S2s and everything, you basically fill everything out. You could, so this is actually, it is a homogeneous space. So just wanted to mention that. Well, it is Friday and everything like that, so this is going to be my final lecture. I hope to talk a little bit about turning on some fluxes and some more non-trivial examples of manifolds with some preserving some amount of supersymmetry. So I guess I'll get started. I'd like to sort of focus the second half of this talk on an example, or to sort of sketch through what Vijay may have mentioned earlier this week about these half BPS solutions, LLM sort of bubbling half BPS solutions. But before I actually get there, I'd like to remind you that the last time we looked at basically just pure geometry type solutions. So just a metric, just some sort of a ordinary manifold with preserving some amount of supersymmetry. And so we've been able to especially make use of holonomy in studying that. And as Catherine Becker said in some of her lectures, things get more complicated when you study flux compactifications or turn on some form fields. And it was particularly illuminating when she discussed sort of the heterotic string compactified with flux, because that acts more or less like a bit of torsion. I'd like to give a slightly different take on that from a 11-dimensional supergravity point of view, but I think it ties in nicely with some of what she was discussing. Good, well, we might as well get started. So let me remind you, at least for today, I'll mostly focus right now on 11-dimensional supergravity. And when we're looking for supersymmetric configurations, we focused on the Killing-Spinner equation given here, where grad hat is the supercovariant derivative. And as long as you have fluxes turned on, then you have to worry about sort of the second term in the supercovariant derivative. And so basically, our goal is to look for supersymmetric configurations by sort of examining the structure or the feature of this entire Killing-Spinner equation. And there are many different ways of doing this. I can't survey everything in one lecture, but let me just highlight a common thing to do is to maybe look for supersymmetric brains or black holes by choosing sort of a black hole metric or black hole ansatz based on symmetries. If I look at sort of a gravity solution for M2 brains or phi brains or things like that, I know there's a longitudinal and a transverse coordinate split. I can write down a metric in sort of a longitudinal transverse form with various warp factors. I could plug it into bosonic equations of motion. I could put it into the Killing-Spinner equation. And with enough symmetry, it turns out to be a very easy problem to solve. Another thing, and something I've been exploring over the last couple of years, is this idea of generalized holonomy. And you recall, if I just had an ordinary covariant derivative, then that tells us we're doing sort of parallel transport with the ordinary Riemannian connection. And the mathematicians basically tell you how to examine the problem. Here we can imagine that the supercovariant derivative is trying to tell us a similar story, except that now there's something like a parallel transport in the presence of fluxes, where we had to take this whole thing into account. And so it's basically just holonomy of a more general connection than the ordinary Riemannian one. Something else I'd like to highlight is there's been some very powerful work done recently, especially pioneered by Jerome Gonsalves and a lot of his collaborators, known roughly as sort of G-structure analysis, and basically focuses on exploring sort of the killing vectors, killing tensors, and additional symmetries you can construct by knowing that you have a killing spinner. And then, of course, you can do combinations of all these different methods. So I'll illustrate this sort of G-structure idea mainly by going through how we can come up with the LLM bubbling solution as we do that. So let me just start by considering the compactifications onto ADS times spheres. These are all pretty familiar. It's known somewhat as the Freund-Rubin ansatz, because even before sort of string theory, when people realized there's this 11-dimensional supergravity, it was natural to say we should take the 11 dimensions and compactify it down to 4 dimensions. It's even sort of suggestive that there's a 4-form field strength. So the number 4, it's like numerology or something. The number 4 says maybe that's going to single out 4 space-time dimensions. Well, it turns out that's not particularly true. But nevertheless, the idea of coming up with a 4+7 split is pretty natural. And so what you can do is just to imagine an ansatz where you take your 11-dimensional metric and just treat it as a direct product, no warping, nothing fancy, of your 4-dimensional space-time times some 7-dimensional so-called internal space. And then the 4-form flux just takes on some value basically proportional to the volume form on the 4 dimensions. This basically just fills up your space over there. Well, if you have the equations of motion and you have this ansatz over here, then it's just all you need to do is plug your ansatz into the equations of motion and see what you have. This is a very nice choice over here because it tells you that the form field equations of motion are automatically satisfied. There's the Bianchi identity. The F equals 0, that's a very simple one because basically it's filled up all of space. D star F fills up all of the 7 space, that also vanishes. And then F wedge F disappears because you can't wedge this with itself the way it's written here. And it just tells you that this M over here is a constant. That's going to be related to basically the curvature or the inverse radius of these spaces. So the only non-trivial equation to look at is Einstein. And you basically just decompose the Einstein equation. It's a very simple exercise. And you end up with sort of a space-time part of the Einstein equation, r mu nu equals, and then some factor over here, and then the internal space, rmn, some factor, gmn. Now, if you think about this, this is saying individually, in 4 dimensions, it's sort of an Einstein space. There's a minus sign here, so it's a negative curvature Einstein space. And then in the internal space over here, it's a positive curvature Einstein space. I pulled out sort of standard factors of 3 and 6. It's sort of dimension minus 1, so that this thing in the parentheses is just naturally what you would associate with the inverse radius of the space. You often note these equations by itself doesn't tell you that it's ADS4 times S7. All it says is they're sort of positive and negative curvature Einstein spaces. But we know if we wanted maximum symmetry, then the maximally symmetric spaces are ADS4 and S7. That's also the case for maximally supersymmetric spaces. And so I'd like to highlight what kind of Killing spinners you have over here for the maximally supersymmetric spaces. Just as an aside, let me also remind you, you can do sort of an opposite Foreign Grubin type thing. You can take the four-form flux and turn it on in an internal space, and that gives you sort of the ADS-7 times S4 system. And you can also do the familiar sort of near horizon of D3 grains, and that gives you ADS-5 times S5. Those are sort of three very standard non-dilatonic type configurations. And there's also, you can talk about self-dual strings in six dimensions, near horizon, that gives you ADS-3 times S3. That could be realized in, for example, a D1, D5 system. So I'd like to look at the supersymmetry, which means we should take the 11-dimensional supergravity Killing spinner equation and look at its components along the internal space and along the space-time or external space. So if you take this equation here and you just plug in what the four-form is, you realize that you can't do this in one line. You have to do it in two lines. For the space-time part, you get sort of a space-time covariant derivative plus some factor over here with all the various Dirac matrices. And similarly, for the internal space, you have something like that. Now, this is not 11-dimensional sort of symmetric, but that's obvious because you've picked the 4+7 split. That means you could sort of rewrite this in a more sort of transparent manner by realizing you can define something like a gamma-5 matrix, which is a 4-dimensional space-time chirality-like matrix. And then these antisymmetric products basically just turn out to the gamma mu gamma 5 or gamma m gamma 5. So these are sort of interesting equations because they apply in a more general setting that this is what you have when you wanted to look for Killing spinners basically on spheres. This is sort of a Killing spinner equation on spheres. This is a Killing spinner equation in anti-de Sitter space. These can be done with or without gamma 5s in a more general setting, but for the particular Foreign Grubin case over here, you just plug it in, and what you see is what you get, basically. So these are the equations. Now, I won't necessarily explain how you get maximal symmetries from these things, maximum supersymmetries, but just remember that these are basically Killing spinner equations for spheres and ADS. Of course, you don't have to solve it for a round 7-sphere. So you can also find partially broken supersymmetric solutions. And as long as you solve the sort of Killing spinner equation with at least sort of one Killing spinner, then you can get at least one space-time supersymmetry. And so people were interested, and I mentioned it before, that if you replace the 7-sphere with a manifold of sort of reduced supersymmetry, and if you preserve 1 out of 8 supersymmetries on the 7-manifold, then you end up with basically an n=1 theory in 4 dimensions. Well, I'm not going to go into that direction, but I'd like to consider at this point another sort of problem we can think about, and that's we found a solution here, ADS 4 times S7, with maximum all 32 supersymmetries being preserved. We should also know that Minkowski space in 11 dimensions also preserves 32 supersymmetries. So you could wonder, you know, are there any other possibilities that preserve all supersymmetries? And it turns out there's exactly 4. This is very nice work done by Figueroa, Alferio, and Papadopoulos that they actually proved. Just by studying the properties of this Killing spinner equation, they proved there's only 4 maximally supersymmetric space-times for the 11-dimensional supergravity. And we've already familiar with Minkowski space, the 2 types of ADS times sphere type solutions. And the last one is interesting, sort of the PP wave geometry. And this was actually found before BMN, but it has this, well, here, dx plus dx minus, Lycombe type directions, plus the rest of the over here. So this is sort of like a game you can play, but actually you learn something to ask yourself the question, how many configurations are there preserving maximum supersymmetry? How many configurations are there preserving half supersymmetry, a half BPS? And you know, can we explore sort of the space of supersymmetric solutions and try to learn more about the structure of the theory in doing so? So part of the idea of classification is to try to understand how we can both classify and construct these types of solutions. Let me just sketch their proof of these four possibilities. Remember when I talked about just pure geometry type solutions, I said if you just had a simple Killing-Spinner equation, grad epsilon equals zero, then if you do integrability with an ordinary covariant derivative, then you just get basically the Riemann tensor times some Dirac matrices acting on epsilon equals zero, sort of R mu nu AB times gamma AB epsilon equals zero. If you have maximum supersymmetry, that means sort of you can choose any arbitrary spinner, epsilon, and therefore every sort of Dirac matrix component in those equations have to vanish, and then you can translate that to saying that all the Riemann sort of components have to vanish, and the space is basically just flat. Well, here you can do the same sort of story, but you have to realize you have to take into account sort of this more generalized connection. So I wrote this in a schematic sense, that if this is the supercovariant derivative with the four form inside it, you can take a commutator, that's still an integrability type thing. It gives you script R over here, which is something like a generalization of the Riemann curvature. This is written as a matrix. This is, there are Dirac matrices in here, so this is basically a matrix. This matrix times epsilon equals zero. And for maximum supersymmetry, you say this matrix times epsilon equals zero, this matrix script R can be decomposed into like one gamma, two gamma, three gamma, and so on terms. You stop basically at five, because if you had any more, like six, seven, eight or so, you could sort of gamma dualize in 11 dimensions. And then all these terms have to vanish independently for maximum supersymmetry. That gives you a whole bunch of equations. And then you just sort of work at it one at a time, and they came up with the only those four things. I mean, proving that there were only those four possibilities. So it's sort of working out the consequences of unbroken supersymmetry. You can imagine this process gets more difficult for something like half BPS solutions, if I had, or even partial supersymmetric backgrounds, because in that case, you cannot sort of strip off the epsilon if only some of these spinners are killing spinners. So that means you only know some of the information. You only know linear combinations of these guys will be set equal to zero. But nevertheless, this is at least in principle one way of looking at proving and classifying these backgrounds. Well, that's sort of thought of as a vacuum type configuration. It's just sort of fluxes and geometry. I'd like to do another example, which is sort of the supergravity M2 brain solution. This you could think of as maybe sort of the external fields or the back reacted fields outside the 11-dimensional supermembrane. But I want to just take a just a very classical gravity sort of point of view. And we know that there are these sort of M2 brains and M5 brains. And for the M2 brain, it's a membrane that sort of couples to gravity. It has some brain tension after all. It also carries mass or tension. That couples, in some sense, to the metric. That's what the mass does. This also has four form charge. It's electrically charged under the four form. It couples to the three form potential. And so this is the supersymmetric M2 brain has sort of a balance between mass and charge. And that tells you that we're going to have to find something with the metric involving whoever, the property of the brain, and something about the electric charge of the brain, and we'll have to tie them together to obtain a VPS-like condition. So I'll sketch how that is done, and we'll see how things really do hopefully fall together. So the tube brain has a three-dimensional world volume, and it's living in 11 dimensions. So it has an eight-dimensional transverse space. That means we seek a solution which has a sort of a three-dimensional longitudinal part and a four and an eight-dimensional transverse part. I assume it's all isotropic along the world volume and more or less up to warping. Similarly, I just take an eight-dimensional Euclidean space over here. It turns out there are generalizations, but let me just look at this. Then you say, well, the longitudinal space could be warped by, say, e to the 2a. The transverse space could be, well, maybe not warped, but at least have a conformal factor of e to the 2b. Now, since I want a solution to be isotropic along the brain, these a and b factors should be dependent only on what I call y, the transverse coordinates. So nothing is going to depend on longitudinal coordinates. This should also carry an electric four-form, which is very natural why I've chosen three dimensions over here, dx0, dx1, dx2. And the last one is just sort of points into the transverse space when you hit a derivative of e to the 2c. So our goal is to basically just solve this system. What I mean by that is to solve it for these functions a, b, and c. Just three functions to solve for. That, I hope, doesn't sound too hard. And in fact, if you wrote down the Einstein equations, the form field Maxwell-like equations, you could just look at that a little bit and probably come up with a reasonable solution. It's not the most trivial thing, but there's sort of enough symmetry to help you along. Nevertheless, there's still sort of second order partial differential equations. And so there's just a little bit of a trick to it. It's better sometimes to actually look at what supersymmetry does right at the beginning. I mean, one technique for examining these supergravity objects is you try to just construct it first based on bosonic equations of motion, and then you check the supersymmetry afterwards. But if you know you're looking for a BPS-like object, it's often best to do both sort of at the same time. So if I look at supersymmetry, and what I want to do is to basically look at, well, you know, the supercovariant derivative, which I sort of wrote up again in two parts. In the world volume with the longitudinal directions, you have grad mu becomes ordinary partial mu plus a spin connection term with mixed indices. And then the four form will also show up over here. I want to just highlight a little bit that, well, it's a nice exercise, but I've already sort of rearranged things a little bit. I've been able to factor out sort of gamma mu gamma I, and then you're left with a partial di derivative, which is a y derivative, a transverse space derivative. Everything functions in the transverse space of a combination e to the 2a plus e to the 2c times some gamma 0, 1, 2 object. The gamma 0, 1, 2 object is something like a gamma 5 matrix. It's something like one of these chirality type matrices. These are 11-dimensional Dirac matrices, so it's okay to have a product of three of them like that. And that 0, 1, 2 is just living along the directions of the M2 brain. And you know, this object here has eigenvalues plus minus 1. So it's very natural to, again, say there's going to be some half BPS projection. I'm going to have plus 1 over here, minus 1 over here, or something. It cancels out, gives me a supersymmetric background. That's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to set e to the 2a equals e to the 2c so that we can cancel these two terms against each other. You can also look in the transverse space. The transverse covariant derivative tends to be a little bit more complicated, but again, I have something here which I want to end up forming sort of a projection with. One thing to note over here, e to the 2a, you remember, is a metric factor in front of the longitudinal coordinates. So this is metric over here. E to the 2c is 4-4. This is mass and this is charge. So this is BPS, mass equals charge. And likewise over here, b is the transverse space metric. C over here is the charge. So it's again mass equals charge. Almost always works like that. Well, the way I wrote it here, e to the minus 3a, dj e to the 2c and everything, it's a little bit awkward, but once you plug in e to the 3a equals e to the 2c, this guy collapses against that guy. This combination is just twice the derivative of c multiplied by minus 1 over 6. It's minus 1/3 derivative of c. So to make this term balance against that term, we're going to take b equals minus 1/3 c. And if you want to write everything exponentially, you have some relation like that. This is nice. This says, one way to read this is I've determined everything in terms of c. If you tell me what the function c of y is, then I will tell you what the functions a and b are. However, this is basically the extent of doing supersymmetry analysis right now. This came back to a previous comment that when you have partially broken supersymmetry, you're not necessarily guaranteed to solve all your equations of motions, just a linear combination, and this is the linear combination in some sense that you've solved over here. Right now, c can be a completely arbitrary random function, and it still solves these Killing spinner equations. So we need some additional input to tell us what is c, and you know the answer, e to the 2c should be a harmonic function, rather the inverse of it should be a harmonic function. But let me remind you, there's no harmonic function thing on this slide over here, because you don't get it from here. Well, I just rewrote it a little bit to highlight. Once you've made those identifications between A, B, and C, then everything just has these sort of projections, which I defined as 1 plus gamma 0, 1, 2, basically. That tells you, to be supersymmetric, we're going to choose a Killing spinner that's going to be the opposite P minus type projection. And when you do that, P plus is going to kill the P minus thing. Epsilon naught is a constant in the spinner. So we know sort of the chirality of the Killing spinner has to be this P minus type chirality. On the other hand, there's this little extra term over here about this minus 1/3 derivative of C. But that's very simple. We can just solve that equation, and that's why there's this e to the 1/3 c factor in front over here. So in order to solve the Killing spinner equations, epsilon, this Killing spinner, is not constant. It's a function of y hidden inside this little factor over there. And I guess I already mentioned that right now we still don't know what the function c of y is. But a way to find out c of y, of course, is to look at your bosonic equations. And usually, once you've solved one of your bosonic equations, by acting with that, with supersymmetry, you generate all your other bosonic equations of motion. So you don't have to plug in and check every single equation of motion. You just have to sort of pick one. And the easiest one to pick is often not the Einstein equation, but the form field equation or a dilaton equation or something like that. So here, if I look at the F4 equation motion, d star f plus the turn sinus like term equals 0, well, again, f wedge f disappears for this purely electrical background, but it's a little bit interesting to consider M2, M5 intersections or things like that. At least for here, it's simple. And you just solve d star f equals 0. But you remember F4, I can write that in terms of d of e to the 2c. So I'm going to end up with d star d of e to the 2c, but there's some metric factors involved in Hodge dualization. So when you're actually done with it, you get d star d e to the minus 2c equals 0. It's kind of cute how it flips upside down, so to speak. D star D is just a transverse Laplacian in eight-dimensional space. And so the solution is to say e to the minus 2c is harmonic in eight-dimensional space. And if you want it to be, you know, super explicit, you can just write it down as 1 plus the sum of charges and centers of all the different membranes. So this is basically just a parallel membrane solution that that is separated as much or as little as you want in transverse space. Now, it's important for this sort of setup over here, this half BPS type setup, that these are parallel membranes, which means the x0, 1, 2 longitudinal directions are basically all shared and the same. If you tried brains and angles, you get a more complicated story. If you tried brains and brains pointing to other directions, sort of brain anti-brain systems and things like that, then it behaves differently also. Anyway, you've probably seen the solution, but I just wanted to consolidate everything and write it down. So we've picked the A, B, and C functions to be related, and the C function given by this harmonic equation. That tells you the 11-dimensional metric is just sort of h to the minus 2/3 times longitudinal stuff, h to the 1/3 times the transverse stuff. And the four form can be written like that. It's an interesting relation. The Killing spinner here is e to the minus, no, sorry, h, the harmonic function to the minus 1/6 power. The longitudinal warp factor here is h to the minus 2/3 power. This thing here is sort of 1/4 of this thing over here. Turns out that's not an accident. And I want to show, not really prove, but I want to show you that it's not really an accident that this harmonic function and this is related by a power of 1/4. And the way to do that is to realize there's actually sort of a, well, it's not very hidden, but it's sort of an isometry that can be realized based on knowing that you have a Killing spinner. And basically, you can demonstrate that there's a time-like Killing vector for this type of solution. And what happens is, if you have a Killing spinner, you can form the bilinear epsilon bar gamma mu epsilon. And this spinner bilinear with the gamma matrix sandwiched inside is, well, it is a vector. And I'll show you that it's a Killing vector, but for now, let's just calculate that. And these epsilons are the sort of y-dependent epsilons. They each have a factor of h to the minus 1/6. I have two spinners, so it's h to the minus 1/3 factor, epsilon bar naught, the constant spinner, gamma mu, constant spinner. Well, if I wanted to write this with a raised index, I'm going to use the contravariant indices for the vectors over here. And this is a curved space Dirac matrix. So the curved space Dirac matrix has a inverse Wheelbine, which will, and the Wheelbine in the longitudinal direction is h to the minus 2/3. Sorry, the metric is h to the minus 2/3 in the longitudinal direction. The Wheelbine is h to the minus 1. H to the minus 1/3, the inverse Wheelbine will exactly cancel this power over here. So I just write that as gamma mu with a bar, meaning sort of flat spaced gamma matrices or matrices with sort of constant plus minus 1 or plus minus I eigenvalues. So this right hand side now is more or less constants. It's, you know, zeros or ones or things like that. And it turns out it's not too hard to demonstrate using 11-dimensional 32-component Majorana spinners, picking the correct representations for your Dirac matrices and everything, that this vanishes except when mu is equal to 0. And that basically says that this vector is just d by dt in this particular geometry. And d by dt is just your time-like Killing vector for this problem. And a way to prove that it's a Killing vector, if you wish, is you remember we've solved the Killing spinner equation. It says grad m plus 1/288, this factor times epsilon equals 0. If that's equal to 0, I just move it to the other side. Grad m epsilon equals minus 1/288, this thing over here. I can take the Majorana conjugate and end up with an expression of this sort. So if I want to actually calculate grad m times the vector, then what you end up with is I can put an epsilon bar on this first equation. I could put an epsilon on the second equation, add them together, and that is sort of just the expansion of this derivative over here. I have to go to add together the right-hand sides, and you get something like that. Well, this is not equal to zero. We're supposed to look at it a little bit carefully and realize the Killing vector equation, or Killing's equation, is to anti-symmetrize on M and N. If I anti-symmetrize on M and N, the right-hand side, M and N, is anti-symmetric. This Hodge dual still keeps M and N anti-symmetric. So after symmetrization, I get d mu v nu equals to zero. This is generally true for any supersymmetric background. You have to be a little bit careful if, in certain cases, in the Euclidean space or something, there's a bit of a catch. This is always true, but epsilon spinner itself, forming this bilinear, this epsilon bar gamma mu epsilon type bilinear, might just give you the number zero. So it might just vanish if you've sort of got the wrong type of spinners. So that certainly can happen. I don't think it happens here in Minkowski space, certainly not in the 11-dimensional case. For like 6-dimensional Euclidean spinners, I think that vanishes. You're saying you can prove it never happens with us. I'm not sure, actually. Partially, there's too many different types of spinners, so I've always explored it sort of case by case. If you have, you know, Dirac spinners or Majorana spinners. If you have an extended supersymmetry, you can also form, you know, epsilon 1 bar, epsilon 2s, and combinations like that. I don't think it vanishes in Minkowski space. Well, we've been maybe dancing around the issue a little bit, but the issue here is that when we're looking at supersymmetric backgrounds with fluxes turned on, then you're considering something like a supercovariant derivative, which has all this other stuff. So it's more complicated than just pure geometry, but I can still think of what it means to have a derivative, covariant derivative, or supercovariant derivative. It's sort of trying to move you around in some sort of a space. And so I can view this as, well, the supercovariant derivative as the ordinary derivative fixed up by some sort of a generalized connection, or the generalized connection that just grabbed from the spin connection plus the sort of form field or the flux type terms. So normally, this thing over here, this gamma AB, if you wish, or half gamma AB, basically generates the Lie algebra of SOD or SO1 comma D minus 1. And that's just the tangent space group, you know. But here I have sort of five gamma and three gamma type terms. So this does not take values into the Lie algebra of SO1 comma 10, but I can still realize that this sort of generates basically the Clifford group, which is just the group of Dirac matrices. And if I start commuting these things around, 2, 3, and 5 Dirac matrices, you start generating the whole thing, which turns out to be SL32R. So I can view this as some sort of a generalized connection that takes values in SL32R. And just as we have a Riemannian holonomy that takes values inside SOD or something like that, here we can have a generalized holonomy contained inside SL32R. And I already highlighted the equation that if you just take integrability, this represents something like a curvature of your generalized connection. You can write it as this sort of script R type matrix. This, again, is something that takes values in SL32R. that's a sort of a different way of looking at holonomy. Just like an ordinary Riemannian manifolds, where you want to count the number of singlets to count the number of preserved supersymmetries, here I can count the number of singlets in the decomposition of the 32-component spinner into the SL32R holonomy. And I could just do a little bit of numerology type arguments over here. Let me just pretend I have n preserved supersymmetries, and I'm clever enough to choose a basis of killing spinners. So let's say this is my first killing spinner, this is the second one, and so on. Basically, just one along the top part of it. So the, of course, you can take linear combinations of preserved killing spinners. So I'm just thinking about the top n entries over here can be arbitrary, but that has to be vanishing in the bottom remaining 32 minus n entries. To be consistent of these things being killing spinners, it says the holonomy of the holonomy of the generalized conduction is normally a SL32R type matrix, but to have killing spinners, I need this sort of generalized curvature matrix times these killing spinners to be equal to zero. Actually, I'm doing the group over here, so it has to be equal to itself. So in order to do that, I can imagine if I have one of these killing spinners over here, this matrix times the killing spinner, well, I've chosen 1, 0 just in the right place to preserve the killing spinners. These other entries over here are completely general. If you just look at the sort of group formed by matrix multiplication, the, if I didn't have anything up here, it's very simple. This is just some 32 minus n component real matrix. So it generates, I'm not explaining why it's determinant one. It turns out that that is inherited from the original SL32 matrix. This is SL32 minus n. And then if you do stick in components over here, the matrix multiplication rules turns out to act as a semi-direct product group. And so we learn, in some sense, that the holonomy is contained in SL32 minus n, semi-direct product, some number of copies of sort of non-compact U1 factors, if you wish, transforming as vectors under the SL group. Now, unfortunately, you should be able to see right now that this is sort of a mess or complicated. If I said something like the manifold of SU2 holonomy, and then you're supposed to sort of say K3 or some non-contact version of that. If I said SU3, you're supposed to say, you know, Clavier. Here, these are not very familiar type groups. Well, I mean, SL is not too bad, but mainly it's a non-compact sort of groups, and they're large. You can hide a lot of things inside here. And so the classification under this generalized holonomy turns out to be a bit of a mess, and we haven't exactly found a particularly enlightening way of looking at it, but it is still kind of interesting that it's hinting at some possible hidden symmetries of 11-dimensional supergravity, which you hope might translate into hidden symmetries of M theory. Since I've already worked out the sort of the generalized connections for the M2 brain, let me just highlight what it looks like for the M2 solution. So again, this is just the supergravity solution. And if you looked at my previous slides, you would have noticed in some sense that if I have kappa omega as the generalized connection, you get two possibilities. You get the connection along the longitudinal guys and then along the transverse direction. This 4/3 dc factor over there is related to sort of that additional factor that showed up in the transverse killing spinner equation. I just wanted to highlight sort of the red guys over here. And over here, when you look at holonomy, when you look at integrability of this connection, this blue term doesn't count because it basically commutes with all the other stuff, so we don't have to worry about it. But then you get a structure along the longitudinal side of this sort of mixed, well, where is it? And this guy over here gives you sort of a mixed longitudinal and transverse index sort of generator. the transverse guy gives you this thing. Well, two sort of space gamma matrices, and these live in transverse space. This generates more or less SO8, compact SO8 from this set over here. It is the longitudinal guys that make things a little bit more interesting. You have to take into account that there are these projections over here. You also have to do higher order integrability to end up with this 4-gamma type term. You can see that this is SO8. So it turns out the generalized phylotomy is SO8, semi-direct product, these guys over here, which generate a whole bunch of non-compact directions, transforming as the spinner of SO8. So if you really wanted to use the generalized phylotomy language, you say for the M2 brain, you have SO8 semi-direct 12 copies of R transforming as 2 copies of the spinner. And this is supposed to be a half DPS solution. So as we saw just in the previous transparency, for a half DPS solution, this should be contained inside sort of half of SL32, should be contained in SL16R, semi-direct, no more than these 16 factors each over here. And sure enough, well, 8 is less than 16, 12 is less than 16, and so on. So it fits, in fact, it fits too easily into this picture. And so there's a lot of freedom in how the holonomy sort of works out. If I did something like the Kaluza-Klein monopole, which is what we looked at last time as the Euclidean Talbot-Knot solution, that is a pure geometry solution, and that's SU2 holonomy. And for the Euclidean Talbot-Knot, or the sort of KK monopole, then you would have SU2 holonomy, generalized holonomy, ordinary holonomy, contained in the maximum thing over here. And SU2 fits in this many, many different ways. So in a way, once you have a solution, you can certainly look at generalized holonomy, and it's a way of classifying your solutions. But in other cases, we would like to actually be a little bit more constructive. We would like to have a method of actually constructing supersymmetric vacua. And a very powerful technique has been developed. I'm sure I've forgotten a few names, which is sort of goes under the name of G-structure analysis. There's actually a mathematical definition of G-structures and a sort of a formal idea of the symmetries involved when we speak of G-structures. But that sort of is lost in the distinction sometimes when we say, when at least I say G-structure analysis, I'm also thinking about really a killing tensor analysis. What is the procedure of constructing explicit supersymmetric solutions based on sort of these killing tensors? And that's what I really would like to focus on, not so much the classification, but the construction side of the G-structure analysis. The very quick sketch is to say, if I postulate the existence of at least one killing spinner, then I can always form bilinears, which is epsilon bar times some arbitrary number of gamma matrices times epsilon. I'm imagining forming all possibilities over here. And so what you learn is if you have a solution that preserves the killing spinner, you can create these sort of killing tensors. They turn out, we've already seen, you can prove there's a killing vector. You can also prove there's other sort of isometries. That tells you something about the background isometries. Once you know that, you might as well just specialize your metric, specialize your ansatz to, without losing any generality, to make these isometries manifest. That simplifies the problem enough, usually. Then you just end up in your specialized coordinate system with a system that's sort of tractable enough or manageable enough to solve, at least for many cases. So I'll outline how this actually works in the LLM case, but the basic procedure is, one thing is, if you want to, generally what you do is you have a killing spinner, then at step one, we construct all possible bilinears of this form, it's useful to look at the algebraic identities, which are basically given by Fierch's rearrangement. That can prove, you know, if I form something like epsilon bar, gamma I, gamma j, epsilon or so, and I call that jij, I can prove that jij roughly squares to minus one. I can prove it's a complex structure or something like that. That is done through these Fierch's rearrangement identities. You wanted to say a little bit more, you know, is it a, covariantly constant object or something like that? Then you need to look at differential identities, which basically are the identities that come from the Killing-Spinner equations themselves. Once you've done all that, you specialize your coordinates and just solve sort of the resulting system. Now I put step number zero over here. Step number zero is, if you're not necessarily trying to find every single supersymmetric background, you can help yourself right at the beginning of the problem by saying, if I'm only looking for gravity backgrounds with a certain amount of isometry, then I might as well specialize the isometry right at the beginning, not at the end. So more explicitly, in the LLM, well, let me, I'll get back to the LLM case. Let me just say what it did over here is basically the procedure of constructing supersymmetric backgrounds. And the other thing about G structures is this serves as sort of a classification scheme as well. Maybe I won't say too much about this because I would like to sort of highlight the LLM construction. But in some sense, if I have an n-dimensional manifold, then sort of in general, I have something like a GLN structure. And in some cases, if the G structure is reduced to, for example, ON, that corresponds to having a metric. If it's special orthogonal, then it's sort of orientable. And on top of it, then you can have, for example, the familiar SU3 or things like that, for which, let's say SU3 structure is more or less something like Clavier. And part of the defining picture of Clavier is you're supposed to have a Kähler form and a Clavier form. Well, as long as you have SU3 structure, you still have these objects. But there's a subtle difference between SU3 structure and SU3 holonomy, and that's the covariant derivative that you use to sort of examine these things. May not necessarily be completely compatible with the G structure. And the part that's sort of not compatible is torsion, or sort of intrinsic torsion. And just a quick example for the Clavier or the SC3 structure is that the intrinsic torsion is related to, for example, the failure of these two forms to close. And when they do, which is vanishing intrinsic torsion, then you end up with SC3 holonomy and ordinary Clavier. I think that intrinsic torsion is not specifically the torsion on a Riemannian type manifold that you could put on it, but it's related to sort of these fluxes that you turn on, which I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. I think it is, actually, but I'm not sure I trust that answer. And that's the real problem. Well, I guess what I like to do is to actually sketch through the supergravity side of the bubbling ADS, or the Lunin-Madicina LLM construction. And they do actually quite a bit in their paper. So I like to just focus on the bubbling ADS5 times S5. This is, of course, related to the very standard sort of N=4 supernatant mill story. You've heard enough about that, so I'm not going to say anything in detail. But it's basically this picture of strings on ADS5 times S5 being dual to N=4 supernatant mills. One way to motivate that is you get the same isometry group, the either superconformal group or the super Poincaré group in five dimensions, with bosonic parts SO24, which is the ADS5 group, and SO6 for the isometries of the phi sphere. And then the duality relates various things. The N=4 Yang mills, you can relate giant graviton string configurations spinning on here, and also possibly exact supergravity backgrounds. But what I want to really look at is sort of this part of the story, the exact supergravity backgrounds. And for example, Vijay gave a very nice set of talks discussing some of the other aspects of these half VPS states. So these states are basically delta equals J. If I look at SO6, I actually can have U1 cubed hidden inside here. So there's J1, J2, J3. I'm interested only in turning on one of the R charges. With that, means from the gauge theory side is I can create operators with delta equals J by looking at the six scalars of supernatant mills theory. You form the standard complex sort of combinations like that. And then you can form strings of operators. And when all is said and done, in the sector, you can relate effectively this theory into a simple model where you just talk about matrices as a function of time. So it's basically matrix quantum mechanics, this time with a right side up harmonic oscillator potential, which comes in some sense from the background curvature of the three sphere that it lives off. And then when you quantize that picture, you end up with basically a free fermion picture, sort of a free fermion phase space, which is just, you know, you fill it up to a Fermi surface or so. You can also have excitations above the Fermi surface or holes beneath, which have interpretations of being dual to giant gravitons. Giant gravitons spinning in S5, but expanding in ADS or expanding on S5. So the fun thing is that LLM, they were able to reproduce this picture from gravity. To do that, we should understand these half VPS states ought to be dual to states that have the same sort of delta equals J structure in supergravity. That means we have knowledge of isometries or symmetries. We're not turning on every single R charge or every single spin, just delta equals J. So if I'm trying to think about supergravity, I'm thinking about this SO24 times SO6 as basically the ADS times the sphere isometry groups. And I can break SO24 into SO2 times SO4, SO6 into SO2 times SO4. And delta, or E0, it's basically rotations on this SO2. The first R charge, let's say, is rotations on this SO2. By doing that, I have not touched SO4 over here. I have not touched this SO4. So in the end, we're going to look for solutions preserving two SO4 symmetries. Symmetries are three spheres. So if I did sort of a probe type analysis, I can think of a three brain, which wraps a three sphere, either in ADS or in S5, and then spinning along S5. To do that, I can write down just sort of the background ADS5 times S5 metric, which the first three terms here is one way of writing sort of ADS5. And then the terms over here is S5. Well, I can write S5 in terms of various level surfaces and put it together in something like that. This is explicitly keeping a three-sphere invariant here and here. And if I just move that around, I realize I would have a three-sphere, a three-sphere. That takes up 6 out of your 10 original dimensions, and your remaining sort of 4 coordinates or 4 dimensions, I just grouped over here. So as long as we're preserving SO4 times SO4 invariants, and we start coming up with a complete, you know, back reaction type solutions, if the brains are wrapping any of these spheres over here in a symmetric way, we're not going to distort the spheres over here, but any back reaction you can put in could, for example, change all these metric factors over there. So basically, this is the motivation. Like, we're looking for a supergravity solution with SO4 times SO4 isometry. Well, if I think in sort of a traditional Kaluza-Klein type language, if I know I have SO4 times SO4 isometry, I might as well start with 2B supergravity in 10 dimensions. I can do a reduction on S3 times S3, basically get rid of those 6 dimensions, and end up with an effective 4-dimensional model. This is a simplification. Instead of having to solve 10-dimensional supergravity equations, all I end up with are something like 4-dimensional supergravity equations. But there's a bit of a catch. This sin squared rho or sine squared theta look very natural in terms of the way I've sort of fibered the spaces. But on the other hand, from a Kaluza-Klein reduction point of view, these are sort of factors like multiplying to overall. It's a factor multiplying to overall volume of these spheres. Those are breathing modes. And breathing modes, in general, are not part of the massless Kaluza-Klein spectrum. They're usually part of the massive tower. And it's usually inconsistent to sort of keep the breathing mode and truncate out your other things. So these tend to be inconsistent reductions from a 4-dimensional point of view. On the other hand, we should not really be scared with the name inconsistent. What I'm talking about as inconsistency over here is not that the theory is just completely wrong and you have to throw it out, but rather if I wrote down some sort of set of fields and looked for just a Lagrangian or something for those fields to sort of have dynamics, they might sort of act as sources to other Kaluza-Klein type towers and would be inconsistent to ignore all the rest of the Kaluza-Klein towers unless I end up somehow still solving your original sort of 10-dimensional equations. Usually it's just a few additional constraints that you need to impose. So if I have an inconsistent theory plus constraints that amount effectively to not exciting Kaluza-Klein modes, then the resulting answer is still okay once it's been lifted back up to 10 dimensions. So that's sort of the point of view I'm taking over here. To do that, let's go back, start from the beginning. So we have 2B theory, and just looking at the bosonic fields, the NSNS fields, and the Ramon-Ramon fields. Well, I'm going to take another sort of idea into account, and that's the dual theory, or the theory is really a theory of sort of D3 brains, or near horizons of D3 brains, where I've pushed them away and I just have sort of five-form flux left over. So I definitely need to keep the metric. I also need to keep the five-form flux, or the four-form potential, if you wish. But D3 brains do not excite the dilaton. And so I'm gonna ignore the dilaton, basically. I'm gonna also ignore the NSNSB field. I'm gonna ignore the Ramon-Ramon scalar, Ramon the two-form potential. Objects that are not related to three brains, I'm just gonna ignore. That means we only have a metric and a self-dual five-form. The metric ansatz says, well, we have 2 3 spheres, and then some 4-dimensional space left over, to write down a symmetric sort of ansatz for the 5-form. The 5-form has to live in 5 of these 10 dimensions over here. They can't live 5 of these 4 dimensions, because there's only 4 dimensions here. It can't live on these spheres. It has to live in sort of a combination, and it's easy to convince yourself that the only thing you can really do is to have sort of 3 legs on a sphere and two legs in the four-dimensional space over here. Now, it does have to be self-dual. So the way to write it is something like that, which is guaranteed, basically, to be self-dual. Now, if you take the 10-dimensional equations of motion, plug in the ansatz, and you sort of turn the crank, and it's not too hard, but it takes a little bit of work, you can realize that you end up with four-dimensional equations of motion that could have been derived from a four-dimensional Lagrangian, like that. This is a not completely unexpected result. Four-dimensional Einstein term, I have warp factor h and g and minus g. Well, I have two spheres here. I can put sort of a warp factor in front of either one of them. I could have e to the a over here, e to the b over here. But when they're written this way, I think of e to the h as the overall volume, and g and minus g as sort of a distortion between the two different spheres. When you do that, you have a h term and a g term in terms of kinetic terms for the scalars. This has sort of a wrong sign, but that's not too surprising because this is in something you might consider a string frame. Since you have a two-form field strength, you also have a Maxwell term with dilaton or scalar coupling. And finally, because you're reducing on spheres, spheres have background curvature. When you reduce on spheres, you get something like a potential term. You have scalar potentials that show up. So this is also very much expected. And so just from the bosonic point of view, this is a consistent bosonic Lagrangian describing just four fields like that in four dimensions. So it sounds like we've maybe made life a little bit more difficult. We started with a metric and a four-form in 10 dimensions. We started with two objects in 10 dimensions, and we ended up with four objects in four dimensions. But in fact, that's kind of fake, because this is a four-dimensional metric instead of a 10-dimensional metric. So in fact, four objects in four dimensions, in this case, is simpler than just those two objects in 10 dimensions. Well, that's the bosonic story. The other thing is to look at the supersymmetry. And so we again start with this equation starting to, well, this is the 2B Killing-Springer equation, or Gravitino variation. And at least just for these fields over here. And so you just plug in the reduction ansatz, you realize this is the 10-dimensional index. And again, the 10-dimensional quantity can live either in four dimensions, or can live on the first sphere or the second sphere. And again, it's sort of a metric object and a form field object. So you got a metric object plus a form field object, metric object plus form field object. These guys over here came from the warp factors, or came from the warping. Well, I do highly recommend filling in the details if you're actually interested in explicitly constructing some of these. But just for an overview, let me not fill in too much of the details. Just realize these are still 10-dimensional Dirac matrices. What I like to do is decompose them. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but basically decompose them into effectively four-dimensional Dirac matrices. One little catch is, if I go back here, these are covariant derivatives on spheres. And what you start with is, that's it. It's just a covariant derivative on the sphere. And there's the issue of what do you do with that. And what's natural in the Kaluza-Klein sphere reduction is to realize that the killing spinners in 10 dimensions ought to reduce as killing spinners on the spheres times sort of spinners in your other spaces. That's because we're looking for preserving supersymmetry. I don't want to do anything fancy with the spinners on the spheres. I want the sphere part of this geometry not to destroy any supersymmetries. So we can take these covariant derivatives and understand that in combination as killing spinners on the sphere type equations. Well, a killing spinner on the sphere is the covariant derivative plus some sort of potential-like term, 1/2 gamma mu more or less. The thing is, it could be plus or minus sign over here, which can be parameterized by a parameter denoted eta. So I'm saying eta is plus or minus 1. It's just something to keep in mind. Could go either way. When you do that, you end up with basically three supersymmetry variations, something like a four-dimensional gravitino variation. I'm not claiming this is four-dimensional supergravity. So it's a four-dimensional component of the 10-dimensional gravitino, but it looks kind of as if it were some sort of a supergravity type thing. And then you have something that looks kind of like a dilatino type variations. And again, you start with one 10-dimensional variation. I've made it into three four-dimensional ones. But really, the four-dimensional ones are actually easier to work with. So the goal of the Killing tensor analysis is basically to take those Killing spinner equations and sort of make the most of them. And I've already sketched the procedure, so this is possible to look at sort of one step at a time. Let me trace that through. So now that we've got our starting point are basically those three equations. We're going to say there's a Killing spinner. And so we're going to take epsilon to be a four-dimensional Dirac spinner. And we formed the bilinears. And I want to form the non-vanishing bilinears. So we can have something like epsilon bar gamma 5 epsilon, epsilon bar epsilon, gamma mu, gamma 5 epsilon, things like that. Some subtleties, I got an I over here, I got an I over here to make these real quantities. For Dirac spinners, I can also form conjugate spinner objects. But let me not worry too much about that. So once you've formed these spinner bilinears, these tensors, and this is more or less, you know, just the kinematical structure of playing with Dirac matrices, the sort of bilinears. Then by field theory arrangement, you can verify that this vector L, the guy with the gamma 5 over here, L squared equals F1 squared plus F2 squared. You can just kind of see L squared is four spinners. All these things are four spinners, and having four spinners like that is sort of perfect. It's screaming at you to say you've got to do some Fierch rearrangement over there. And in fact, that's what this is. This is a nice equation, because F1 squared plus F2 squared with real or Hermitian quantities over here, this is a non-negative number. In fact, I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to say that this is a positive number. When this is a positive number, then k has a minus sign. So k squared is a negative number. K squared is a non-vanishing time-like vector. It turns out it will be a time-like Killing vector. L, in this case, is a space-like vector. So you see, we've already learned something. This is interesting, because this is one of those sort of fundamental facts of supersymmetry that in many cases, again, there's dimensions and types of spinners, but this is almost universal to say if you have preserved supersymmetry, you have a time-like Killing vector. It turns out that this could have been zero. So generally, the statement is with any BPS or with any preserved supersymmetry, you have either a time-like or a null Killing vector. So at least in the time-like cases, it's saying something about BPS configurations being static configurations. That's one of those features of supersymmetry. Anyway, let's start exploring sort of the guts of the work, which is to start looking at the differential identities. There's tons of identities I could write. I just wanted to highlight sort of sketch. Generally, what you would do if you're faced with an unfamiliar system is you want to do a more complete analysis. I'm cheating because I know the right answer, you just sort of follow what has already been done. But for other things, you know, you have to come up with sort of analysis yourself. Anyway, for the differential identities, I'm looking at, for example, the gravitino variation. Grad mu epsilon plus 1 over 16th I whatever, so on epsilon equals 0. Again, I move it to the other side. I grab mu epsilon equals minus 1 over 6 things, you know, so on like that. If I know that's true, I can take, this time, the Dirac conjugate to get an equation like that. So if I take the k mu vector, and I say, what is the covariant derivative of the k mu vector? And again, I can have the derivative acting on epsilon bar, or the derivative acting on epsilon. These two equations up here give me enough information to figure that out. Basically, I add together the right-hand side, sandwiching with the right number of right epsilons in the right places, and you end up with an expression like that. F2 and F1 are those scalar bilinears. And you have F mu nu and star F mu nu. Again, just like in the M2 example I gave you, if you symmetrize on mu and nu, these guys are antisymmetric, and you end up with basically killing this equation. And that, this is why I said k is a time-like Killing vector. Once you know it's a time-like Killing vector, we're able to specialize our coordinate system so that k is just d by dt. One more thing we could figure out is if we have the gamma mu, the gamma phi vector, the L mu vector over here, that means we're going to take an expression like this, multiply it on the left by gamma 5, and then by epsilon bar. This guy over here, multiply on the right by gamma 5. You know, things like that. And put it together, you have an expression of this sort. Now, mu and nu indices here. Now, mu and nu are sort of symmetric objects. That means if you symmetrize this, you don't get anything particularly interesting. But if you anti-symmetrize on mu and nu, the right-hand side disappears. Well, anti-symmetrizing is like doing an exterior derivative. I can write this as dl equals 0, where I regard l as a one-form. So this is a closed one-form, and this is a Killing vector. Again, we can specialize our coordinates and call l just dy. I've chosen a coordinate y such that in this coordinate system, l is just dy. But this is very good. Because remember, we're working in a four-dimensional system. I already told you exactly what two of the coordinates are, which leaves only two more to kind of worry. Well, what else we can do is for the Gravitino variations, we can also form combinations that represent sort of the derivatives of the F1 and F2 scalar type bilinears. And if you see sort of the F1, you end up with this star F times K. Remember, now we know K is a Killing vector. And in fact, we know that the new index, the K vector, is pointing in time, basically, which means this is the time component over here. But there's a Hodge star over here. So this F is really picking out sort of the spatial part of F, magnetic field. Likewise, in this expression over here, F mu nu k nu is picking out the electric field, or flux. And so as long as neither one of these equations is trivial, we end up with a solution that in this four-dimensional coordinate system carries electric and magnetic flux. What I didn't highlight is there are other equations, these sort of Dilatino-like equations. The Dilatino equations are really fun to work with because they don't have any grad mu epsilon terms. The Dilatino equations are algebraic in the Killing spinner. So you end up with nice, simple algebraic type equations when you do this sort of put the bilinears together for the Dilatino equations. More precisely, for like F1 and F2, you have like F1 d mu of your scalars equals, you know, the magnetic term or the electric term. So I can combine this F1 equation with this F1 equation. Basically, the right-hand sides are the same up to a factor of 2. And that gives you an expression. The derivative of this quantity in the brackets, e to the minus 1/2 h minus g f1 equals 0. And you know, you're supposed to be able to solve that in your sleep. It just says the thing inside the brackets is a constant. So I can write f1 as some constant times e to the 1/2 h minus g. And likewise, f2 can be written as a constant, e to the 1/2 h plus g. I still didn't tell you what the functions h and g are. They're effectively like scalars. I didn't say what they are, but if you knew what h and g are, I know what f1 and f2 are, or I could turn that around. If I know something about f1 and f2, then I can figure out h and g. So let's review a little bit about what we've learned so far, and what we've learned in some sense is, let's see, we can get a few more things over here. For the Dilatino equation related to h, this is just to highlight the example, we had d/h times epsilon plus this term over here equals 0, move it on the right-hand side. If I sandwich this whole thing with the epsilon bar on the left, then you get epsilon bar d/h epsilon, epsilon bar d/, or epsilon bar gamma mu epsilon, this is the Killing vector k, so it's k mu d mu h. And then on the right-hand side, you get some epsilon bar epsilon term, or an epsilon bar gamma 5 epsilon term, which are the f2 and f1 terms. So you end up with k mu d mu h, so the derivative of h along the Killing direction equals I times this thing over here. These are real quantities, so all you do is take real and imaginary parts. It tells you h, the derivative along the time direction, vanishes, no surprise. That's your static solution. It says to your Killing vector, that sort of d by dt isometry extends not just to your metric, but to your entire system of equations. I didn't show that for f and g, but it's also true. Now, the right-hand side doesn't seem to have any derivatives at all, which is sort of a fun thing. It turns out to give you just an algebraic equation, a times eta plus b eta tilde equals 0. And let me remind you, eta and eta tildes were constants chosen to be plus or minus 1, which were related to Killing spinners on the first three-sphere, or the second three-sphere. If you start specializing a little bit, you could, for example, choose a equals 1, b equals 1, eta equals 1, minus eta tilde equals 1, things like that. But in fact, it turns out you can sort of specialize it in two possible ways. Well, actually, you can do more, but if you're looking at chiral primaries instead of sort of anti-primaries or something, you end up with only two. There's still a little bit of a convention, but you basically end up with two possibilities. And it turns out that with all these things going on, I'm not really explaining it, the first possibility gives you sort of a quarter BPS. The second possibility gives you your other quarter, and you put it together into a half BPS type Killing spinners. But a fun thing is if you've learned a few things about, so F1 and F2 were given here and here. We also remember what happened when we looked at the Fierce identities. We found out L squared equals F1 squared plus F2 squared, things like that. Well, F1 squared plus F2 squared is just e to the h times this e to the g plus e to the minus 2g. E to the g plus e to the minus 2g is just 2 cosh of g. So this is sort of these hyperbolic trigs sort of showing up very automatically. Well, with the time-like Killing vector and with the closed dy1 form, it allows you to take your four-dimensional metric, write it with the time over here, plus it might have a little shift. You can't, just from the information so far, you can't necessarily get rid of the shift. But then you also have a dy squared expression over here, plus your two other coordinates in a two-dimensional space. You can always make a two-dimensional space conformally flat. So I just pulled out a sort of conformal factor times the two-dimensional space. And then all these functions, h and things like that, you can kind of figure out from the previous expressions. Turns out there's another cute little thing which tells you that the capital H function, e to the h equals y. Well, there's a normalization constant, but I've chosen all the constants equal to 1. So the way I've chosen it, it comes out to be something like that. That says little h 1 over h squared equals 2y cos g. So that tells you this factor here is 2y cos g, basically. Likewise, this is 1 over that. Little additional work is used to show that this conformal factor can be chosen to be 1. I don't want to get into that. So that's sort of the metric. We also look at the form field. And there's enough information from, I copied this from the previous transparency. Remember, there's a magnetic sort of piece and electric sort of piece. If you know what F1 and F2 are, you can sort of re-express what F, the form field, is. And so F2 ends up with an electric piece, if you wish, and a magnetic piece. Again, the way it's written here is a little different from what's in LLM on the magnetic term, but it's more or less equivalent after some manipulations. I'm writing it this way just to highlight that these things, excuse me, came directly from F1 and F2. The last thing we need to know is there's the shift vector in the metric. And to obtain the shift vector, we look at some more of these differential identities. I wrote down grad mu k nu. And when you symmetrize grad mu k nu, that's the Killing vector equation. But you can also anti-symmetrize grad mu k nu. So I can write down sort of dk, viewing k as a one form, equals something over here. Now, this by itself is not too interesting, but you can also realize that once I have a metric, once I have this metric, I know the Killing vector is just d by dt, and if I know what h minus 2 is and something like that, it tells you that you can write down the Killing vector k as a one form, basically with covariant components as that. And if I look here, this is k and this is dk. Well, then I want these guys to be compatible. And that gives you an equation that can be related, that relates sort of dv with star d tangent hyperbolic g. Now, if I take this literally to mean dv, then I have a compatibility condition. If I hit this whole expression with another exterior derivative, d squared disappears. So I'm going to have d of this expression equals 0, which is d of 1 over y star dz equals 0, where I have to find the LLM function z as 1/2 tangent hyperbolic g. This LLM definition here, tangent hyperbolic lives between plus minus 1, this more or less lives between plus minus 1/2. Well, you see this compatibility condition is a second order equation on z. And in fact, it's a reasonably simple second order equation. Well, it's got this extra 1 over y, but it turns out that this 1 over y in the x1, x2, and y directions is basically a three-dimensional harmonic function where you view this as three-dimensional constant vector curvature or hyperbolic space. Well, that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to play with z a little bit. So this is just a quick summary of saying I have a metric like that and a form field, if you wish, with these various functions defined. What I wanted to mention is this compatibility condition, d star 1 over y dz equals 0, is basically just a three-dimensional Laplacian on a hyperbolic space. Or if you rewrite it as z over y squared, then it is effectively a six-dimensional Laplacian on sort of an auxiliary six-dimensional space, where in the y-coordinate, it's sort of just a radial direction in R4, and you're only looking at symmetric or S-wave type solutions on R4. This six-dimensional space is very nice, because I'm not saying it's precisely the same thing, but if you think back to sort of three brains in 10 dimensions, three brains in 10 dimensions naturally have a six-dimensional transverse space. So this auxiliary six-dimensional space is somewhat related to the sort of reason that he had three brains in the first place. Well, I'm afraid I'm more or less out of time, so let me just try to finish it up. Once you have a harmonic function, you realize, well, box up the z over y squared equals 0. One way to do that, the beautiful thing about harmonic functions is it's linear superposition. But we've done something interesting, or rather, they have done something interesting, which is to take a nonlinear system, you know, gravity, and find sort of a linear equation that generates the solutions. And this is really the magic of BPS. This is the magic of supersymmetry that allows things like this to happen. Given the linear system, we can write down a solution in terms of a Green's function. What I've done over here is to realize that something sort of bad might happen at y equals 0. Y equals 0, I have to be a little bit careful about. So this Green's function is given in terms of a initial data or boundary conditions that are imposed at y equals 0. So if you're given boundary conditions at y equals 0, then this is the whole function z of x1, x2, and y. So basically, you can see in the 10-dimensional metric, there's y times this thing. As y goes to 0, everything inside here seems to disappear. And then you have a collapsing six-dimensional manifold, which is singular at the tip of the cone, unless you arrange things just right. So the way to arrange things is to look at the six-dimensional manifold, and you cannot have both of the S3s collapsing to zero size at the same time. The only way it can work in a smooth manner is still to have something like dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. At the tip of the cone, you have to end up with one of the spheres keeping finite radius and the other sphere sort of collapsing just to form four-dimensional sort of locally Euclidean region. That tells you either e to the g or e to the minus g has to go to zero. And if I think about this z function, this one-half tangent hyperbolic g, if either this guy goes to zero or that guy goes to zero, then this z basically goes to plus or minus one-half. So this is really the origin of the boundary conditions. It says at the y equals zero plane, you have to more or less have z equals plus minus one-half. Let me not go through the details, but z equals plus minus one-half. This is very nice, because it should tie back in to the free fermion picture of the Mills side of things, and that's because now I can draw sort of a picture to represent my boundary conditions. And it's like binary, one or zero. BJ had one or zero. I've just shifted things here to a plus or minus one-half, and it's basically at y equals zero, I can sort of shade in the regions of minus one-half. Well, there's a flip of the two, three spheres, so it doesn't matter what. Let me just, by convention, shade in the minus one-half areas and leave the plus one-half areas empty. So for every picture I draw, I have a boundary condition, and vice versa. For every set of regular boundary conditions, I can draw a picture. You already probably know the answer. If I just had a perfect circle over here, I'm not going to work through this, but if you had a perfect circle, you end up with ADS space. I do want to get to the next page just to say this is kind of a non-trivial way of getting ADS5 times S5. This clever solution and this clever sort of x1, x2 plane and things like that turns out to be very complicated when it translates back into a 10-dimensional bubbling metric itself. You go through all these sort of nasty transformations, and the interesting feature is when all is said and done, the 10-dimensional metric can be written as something like this, which is ADS5 plus something like that, which is S5. This thing has sort of dt minus one-half d phi, and this has dt plus one-half d phi. T is pi. Phi is that thing that's going around the circle, and this sort of shows you that you really have a mixing between t and phi in some sense. You know things are supposed to sort of move around in phase space like that. So when you go back to this ADS sort of time coordinate, things or giant gravitons really are spinning around on the phi sphere. Although the picture of the boundary condition is a static picture, what happens in space-time is the giant gravitons are really zipping around. So good, I'm afraid I'm a little over my time, so let me just end with that and just highlight perhaps, here's a very incomplete list, but a few sort of reviews and things which I thought were very useful. A perimeter mark. Kind of knew this was coming. Exactly.